Now the time it takes for the letter or package you ship via the U.S. Postal Service could get a little slower, thanks to parts of a 10-year plan to update the federal agency drawn up by current Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. The plan aims to deal with budget shortfalls under the current funding system, but the plan, and mail service in general, has seen controversy over the last year, including concerns about delivery speed for things like mail-in ballots and holiday packages. Jacob Bogage is a reporter for The Washington Post, covering business and technology, the coronavirus, and the U.S. Postal Service. Jacob, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always great to be with you.
Well, remind us, first of all, of the budget situation facing the post office that's kind of behind this 10-year plan. Unlike a lot of government departments, the Postal Service has to break even, right?
That's right. The Postal Service does not get taxpayer money, or at least it's not supposed to. It's supposed to subsist on the sale of postage products. That was really great for a long time because we didn't have the internet. So if you wanted to communicate, you called somebody on the phone or you sent them a letter. We don't do that anymore. And because we're sending less mail, the Postal Service doesn't have as much money as it used to. And so to fund itself, it needs to cut costs to keep its bottom line even. So that's where we get with the 10-year plan. Parts of it try to invest in the Postal Service to cut costs down the road. Parts of it will slow service to cut costs in the near future. And some of it's just some reorganization as well. And then another part is some funky accounting. And that's how we get to, you know, what could be some really meaningful impacts for consumers.
Before we dig further into the plan, let's look at the person at the center of all this, Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General, seen some controversy over the last year. Can you tell a little bit of his story, how he came to be the Postmaster General, why some people don't like that he's still Postmaster General?
Yeah, absolutely. So Louis DeJoy is a former supply chain logistics executive. That's the business of getting something from point A to point B, in his case, mostly on trucks. And he's also a major donor to the Republican Party and a major donor to former President Donald Trump. The Postal Service, as it was battling with its finances when the pandemic started, needed some more money from Congress and needed the president's approval to get more money from Congress. And the White House, we've reported, exerted an incredible amount of influence on the Postal Service to raise prices here and cut costs there, and ultimately persuaded the Postal Service's Board of Governors to take the candidate of its choosing for Postmaster General, and that was Louis DeJoy. He enters the Postal Service as it needs to cut costs and starts changing a bunch of things on the eve of the election that aroused a bunch of suspicion from Democrats and voting rights advocates about how we were going to vote in November and October of last year, because a lot of us voted by mail. And that suspicion or distrust continues to this day.
Talking to Jacob Bogage from The Washington Post, looking at the latest news on the U.S. Postal Service, its leadership, and a plan, a 10-year plan to change services and to try to save money. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on the future of the U.S. Postal Service or questions for our guest, again, 800-642-1234. All right, Jacob, that's under President Trump. And some of the same critics you were referring to there thought maybe that under President Biden, Louis DeJoy's days would be numbered as Postmaster General. He's still there. How come?
Yeah, he's still there. And that's because the president does not have a direct route to firing the Postmaster General. The Postmaster General is appointed and serves at the pleasure at the Postal Service's Board of Governors. Think of it like a company's board of directors. And the Board of Governors generally like him. There's 9 members. Four of them were in office when the Postmaster General was appointed. 6 of them were in office when they approved his 10-year plan for the agency to slow down mail service and to increase prices. And then President Biden appointed 3 more later on. And so the votes are still there to keep Louis DeJoy in office.
Let's look at the plan a little more now. How does a modernization plan end up making packages and letters in some places take longer to get from point A to point B?
Yeah, and so think about it this way. I am sitting here in Washington, D.C. You all are in Wisconsin. If I wanted to send you mail frequently that mail could fly on a plane to get to you. It's a airmail is a postal service tradition dating to 1918. It's been around a long, long time. This plan is going to cut about half of the mail that used to fly on planes, and they're going to put it on trucks and truck it across the country or truck to different places. Obviously, it takes a lot longer for something to go in a truck across the country than it would to go on a plane. That is the root of this slowdown. But when you put that in practice across the country, it has very disparate effects on different parts of the country. Going from west to east, from the west coast to the east coast, it's going to take a lot more time for mail to get delivered. And we were able to really identify some of the hardest hit places, places like pretty much the entire west coast, Portland and Seattle, near Houston, near Orlando. Basically, if you are on the extremities of this country, your mail is going to take longer to reach you, especially if it's coming from out of state.
We're talking to reporter Jacob Bogage from the Washington Post, looking at a lot of the latest news around the U.S. Postal Service, the Postmaster General's long-term plan to modernize the agency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important is the Postal Service to you, especially where you live? Do you still send letters by mail? Do you send packages through the U.S. Postal Service more than you did in the past, maybe? I don't know. How would a slowdown in service impact you? And what do you think of the current Postmaster General? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with the U.S. Postal Service, its budget, its 10-year plan for the future, and its leadership. Washington Post reporter Jacob Bogage stays with us. He covers the USPS, among other things. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you see ways that the Postal Service could save some money? Are you willing to say, hey, stuff can move a little slower if that helps meet the bottom line there? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my comment, well, first off, I just want to say, the USPS being one of the oldest institutions in America, back to the days of the Pony Express, and being one of the crucial institutions at various points in our country's history. And, I share, as the guest mentioned earlier, I do have quite a few misgivings about the current Postmaster General, both because of some of the actions he took prior to last year's election, like the removal of high-volume mail sorting machines as well as the fact that, if I remember correctly, Louis DeJoya also has a pretty significant stake in a competing delivery company, and not one that was run very well, incidentally.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Mike brings up something we haven't gotten into, Jacob, concerns about Louis DeJoy's possible conflicts of interest, people have claimed. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, this was something that has been a concern since his name surfaced for when he was hired for this job, and has continued to dog him. And we've done some reporting on that previously. DeJoy ran a company called XPO Logistics. It purchased or helped run that company. It purchased his family business, which he grew from a small trucking firm into a kind of national powerhouse. And recently, the Postal Service announced it will contract out crucial parts of its processing centers and give them to XPO Logistics, and we'll pay XPO Logistics $120 million to do that. Now, Louis DeJoy says he has nothing to do with the selection of that contract. That still has raised a lot of, what's the right word? Mistrust again, especially because DeJoy continues to draw annual revenue from this company. He leases XPO office buildings to the tune of more than $2 million a year. So there are folks do have concerns about potential conflicts of interest between DeJoy and some of the companies that compete or contract with the Postal Service.
Thanks for the call, Mike. And Louis, or Jacob, I'm sorry, Mike also mentioned that Louis DeJoy, or at least the USPS under Louis DeJoy, had, he said, removed some high-speed mail sorting machines prior to the election. I have dim memories of people making that claim. I don't remember how it all panned out,
though. No, that's right. 671 high-speed sorting machines. There's a give and take there to what Mike was saying, the caller. These removals of sorting machines, they are planned out far in advance of when they're actually removed. So those, the plans for those removals did predate Louis DeJoy, and some of those machines are removed every year. This was about 10% of what the Postal Service has in terms of its capacity of sorting machines. Normally they only do 2 or 3%. So it was certainly an increase. We don't really know why it was increased that much. Based on all of the investigations that my colleagues and I have done, and the inspector generals and other folks in government have done, those removals don't appear to have had much, if any, impact at all on the way the Postal Service executed during the election.
Thanks again for the call, Mike. And Jacob, I know there has been talk, and you've written about this some, of, hey, Congress doing something to update the charter with the U.S. Postal Service. What kind of things are out there? What are the chances of them passing?
Yeah, Congress has looked at postal reform for years and years and years now, and I have sources who will call me because they know I'm a big fan of Snoopy and the Peanuts comics and say it's like Lucy with the football and Charlie Brown, that we get so close to passing postal reform and it doesn't happen. We are somewhere down that road again in this Congress. Postal reform has been a priority in the House, specifically to restructure the way the Postal Service pays for its retirees' health care, which is a Byzantine system that we don't have time to get into right now. That is the main driver in this legislation. There's also talk the Postal Service, and you guys are up in Wisconsin, so I'm sure a lot of your listeners care about Oshkosh Defense, is purchasing up to 165,000 new mail trucks from Oshkosh Defense, and they'll start hitting the streets by 2023. There's also some talk about getting funding to help the Postal Service purchase those trucks and make them electric trucks instead of gasoline powered. And that potentially could make its way into this reconciliation budget package that's being debated right now in both the House and the Senate.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jacob, what are you watching for next, given all the threads to the USPS story?
Oh, my. I am watching very closely to see if that money stays in the reconciliation package. As we know, there's some disagreement about what dollar amount that will come in at. So that's one thing I'm looking at. The other thing I'm looking at is President Biden is going to have the opportunity to nominate two new governors to replace folks on the postal board in December. And that could be very influential on Louis DeJoy's future with the Postal Service.
Jacob, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Jacob Bogage. He covers the U.S. Postal Service, among other things, at the Washington Post. And he joined us today to look at several USPS stories, including coming slowdowns in delivery times, along with big changes in the works from the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Between June and August, the number of kids and teenagers hospitalized for COVID increased fivefold around the U.S. Two CDC studies found that as the Delta variant has spread across the country, more kids have gotten seriously ill. Children are especially likely to be hospitalized in parts of the country with low vaccination rates. Children appear also to be at risk for developing long COVID. About 2-3% of kids are at risk of developing long-term health issues after contracting COVID-19, including developmental delays, diabetes, and memory problems. In general, though, children are still at a substantially lower risk from COVID than adults are. Taking a look now at how long COVID affects children and adults, Ajay Sethi is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Before I get into kids and long COVID, a piece of kid-related COVID news, the company that makes the Pfizer vaccine put out some pretty positive news today. Not a done deal yet. They're going to be applying for FDA approval before too long. What you're seeing now, what do you make of this news and the possibility that there will be a vaccine for kids, I think, in the age range 5 to 11?
Yeah, that's right. It is good news. Pfizer put out a statement that giving one-third a dose of vaccine to children between the ages of 5 and 11 produces an immune response that you would expect would be protective based on what has been observed in teens and adults. The vaccine is safe in kids as well. Of course, they haven't shared the data yet. They're going to be now assembling that. It will be reviewed by the FDA, and hopefully by Halloween, children between the ages 5 and 11 will be eligible for the vaccine under emergency use authorization.
Now, as I mentioned, kids are at lower risk from COVID than grown-ups are. That's, I think, still true under Delta. But because Delta is spreading so quickly, a lot more kids are getting exposed to it. What are we seeing when it comes to illnesses and hospitalizations among children?
Yeah, now that schools are largely being held in person, with in-person instruction, more kids are getting exposed, and especially in those school systems where masks are not being widely used. And the more kids who are exposed, of course, then more kids become ill, and we are seeing a rise in hospitalizations, including kids in the ICU, which is really very much preventable. If everybody who's eligible to get a vaccine can get vaccinated, we'll see less rates of COVID in children.
One of the things that prompted us to give you a call is this ongoing somewhat mystery of long COVID. What do we mean when we say long COVID or long haul COVID?
Yeah, so this is, there are a lot of terms for this, like sort of a post-COVID syndrome. And usually it takes 3 to 4 weeks to recover from COVID. And if there are any lingering symptoms after 4 weeks, then someone may be, believed to have what's called long COVID. The symptoms, can vary. There's a wide range, and it presents itself pretty similarly in kids and adults. But you get difficulty breathing, some shortness of breath, fatigue is commonly reported. Sort of losing your breath after you just, engage in minor physical activity. Brain fog, also something that's reported. These things tend to resolve themselves, but they can last a while, and they can be very worrisome. And people have equated this to things like chronic fatigue syndrome and other sort of post-viral syndromes.
What are some of the thoughts on causes for this? You mentioned the phrase post-viral there. There's not a thought, I think, that the virus is still active in these people, right?
No, so there are probably lots of different mechanisms, and long COVID could be an umbrella term for many different kinds of syndromes, each with its own pathology. So the immune system is very active when somebody has COVID infection, and some of it might be that imbalance that occurs because of that. Some might be physiologic. Some people have also posited that little bits of the virus still remain in the cells, causing damage that might cause some of these syndromes. We know that COVID can affect multiple organs, and because of that, the recovery can be quite complex and quite lengthy.
What kind of research is out there now to try to figure out what's causing this long-haul COVID or these different kinds of long-haul COVID?
Yeah, well, a lot of people are involved. So the neurologists are certainly focusing on the brain fog and the memory issues and attention issues that are occurring in some people and kids. The immunologists are certainly interested in knowing what role the immune response plays and sort of what kind of dysregulation has occurred. People who study oxidative stress, the buildup of oxygen in our cells that leads to damage of those cells, are also involved. The mechanisms are still being worked out, but there are some similarities, again, with things like Epstein-Barr virus infection, which causes mononucleosis, can have a long recovery period. Chronic fatigue syndrome also sometimes has a viral trigger. People are studying and comparing how the physiology may be similar and different. Most likely, it's going to be, multiple different mechanisms. And right now, we just have one umbrella term for all of it.
Do we know if there's a link between the severity of the initial COVID illness and the risk of long-term COVID?
It's not highly correlated. You would think it would be, but it turns out people who have mild, maybe even asymptomatic disease, including kids, down the line can start to experience some of these long COVID symptoms. And that's yet another mystery for this virus. And it I think it creates a little bit more worry that even a mild case can lead to long-term symptoms.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest news on COVID-19, including the risks of so-called long COVID or long-haul COVID, symptoms that persist after initial disease, and the risks for kids, both of initial infection and that long-term illness. Ajay, I want to turn to, I guess, regional differences in our vaccination rates. It seems like there's high risks of outbreaks in some places that are often the least vaccinated parts of our state or our country. What are you seeing?
That's right. There's a pretty strong correlation, actually, that where we're seeing the most cases in kids is where adults are less likely to be vaccinated. Here in Wisconsin, you know, about 45-46% of 12 to 15-year-olds are vaccinated, even though they're eligible. They might also likely have parents who are not vaccinated as well. But vaccination rates are higher with increasing age. It's just not high enough. Again, children under 12, 11 years and younger are just not eligible to be vaccinated yet. And the best way to protect them is for everyone older to get the vaccine.
Looking at the Delta variant in particular, the reason it's become such a problem, it seems like, Ajay, is it transmits so much faster and more easily than the initial versions. Not that an individual case will necessarily be more dangerous. It's just that spread. Is that why it has us so concerned?
Yeah, that's right. The mutations in the spike protein for the Delta variant allow it to reproduce quite a bit. And people who are infected with the virus end up putting out a lot of virus. They're very infectious. And then when you're exposed to that kind of dose as well and begin, you know, producing more virus yourself after infection, even if you're vaccinated, you really end up overwhelming your immune system. If you're vaccinated, it will kick in and you'll clear that far faster than someone who is unvaccinated. And we're finding it's easily spread and it's not very difficult to experience symptoms after exposure.
A big question a lot of people may have, especially older people listening, may be about booster shots. We're hearing from the White House and the FDA now talk about who should get booster shots, some recommendations for more at-risk people. Who out there should be thinking, yes, I need that booster shot, I'm eligible, how do I get it?
Yeah, right now, so boosters are recommended for people who did not develop protection after two doses. So we won't really call that a booster, we'll call it a third dose. So people who are immunocompromised. The FDA advisory panel had met last week about looking at the data for boosters, and they recommended that people older than 65 should get boosted. And younger than that, the data aren't convincing that it's necessary at the moment. That's the first step in the process. The ACIP for CDC will review the data and then make a recommendation. Eventually, our state health department will then translate that to guidelines, and health systems around the state will be ready to begin vaccinating people who are deemed eligible.
Ajay, in our last couple minutes, last year, things really started to ramp up here in Wisconsin, I think in around October. Are you worried that our peak may be coming soon with Delta?
Yeah, the models are predicting it's going to be in October and in November, similar to last year. If you look at the country, we started seeing high rates in the South. It's been creeping up. As it's moving north, it's now in West Virginia and Tennessee, and Wisconsin is nearby. Definitely worried about that. And it's already, the data today shows a large number of cases that were newly identified.
And as you watch for public health, what are you telling people when they ask you questions, Ajay, about our risk here?
The risk is, it's going to get worse before it's going to get better. The stress in the healthcare system is not trivial, and healthcare workers are exhausted across the state. Too many people are not vaccinated, and that's the best way to protect themselves, our community, our healthcare system, and it's something that people should choose because we have such safe and effective vaccines.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Ajay Sethi is an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at some of the latest news about COVID-19, including concerns about longer-lasting symptoms from the illness and the risks for kids during the Delta variant.